Welcome all, the Accidental Engineer here. Today we have the pleasure of Christian Foster Howes joining us. Christian is founder of Little Mission Studio, which is a music school in the Mission neighborhood of San Francisco, California, USA. Christian has a serious background in engineering, ex-VP of engineering at StarMaker, a music startup, hiring manager, has worked in a bunch of different industries, but at this point in his career is, as I said, founder of Little Mission Studio, and still very much involved and intrigued in the software engineering field. Yeah. So,
doing work for various parties in that world as well.
Indeed. And some of that educational itself. So Christian, do you mind sharing a little bit more about your background than I've given and
sure.
And how you found your way to engineering?
Yeah, well how I found my way to engineering. We go all the way back, actually, when I think I was probably about the eighth grade, and my older brother was doing like the SATs, and you know, the dinner table conversation was, what do you want to be when you grow up? And so that, you know, my older brother, and then they looked down at me, and I'm like, I'm going to be a musician. And like the immediate reaction was, no, you're not. You're not going to make any money that way. And you should be an engineer. And I've always enjoyed the math and the science and all of that. And I've really enjoyed the music stuff. But that moment in my mind is when I decided to be a double major.
Got it.
And so I made it to University of Michigan, got my degrees in percussion performance and computer engineering, and have been lucky enough to do both mm-hmm. throughout my life. I've worked software in telco with time spent in Europe on customer sites, worked for a design consultancy for a period of time, several different startups. I've helped sort of like get them some footing, spent a big chunk of time at StarMaker, which makes a karaoke app. They still do, but there was a change in ownership and it was time for me to move a different way. But I've been an active performer and player of music throughout all of this, and 3 years ago now opened Little Mission Studio with some friends of mine, which really helps me get into that. So
you've had a surprise. Well, our audience has a huge and surprising overlap with music performance and a surprising number play instruments themselves. Having worked on technology software for music at StarMaker, what's kind of the intersection that you see the most between software engineering, programming, and systems design, and musical performance?
Well, there's all sorts of things, but probably the thing that, whether or not you're actually working on software that is music related, right? Some people approach an engineering problem strictly as a mathematical problem, like it's right, it's wrong. Software is never that black and white. Mm-hmm. And there is an element of artistry in everything that you produce, right? When somebody talks about elegant code, well, your idea of elegant code is probably different than my idea of elegant code, right? Which way should I do this thing? Well, there's probably five different ways. And one of them's more efficient, one of them is easier to maintain, one of them, right? And so being able to look at all of these things and bring that art, that creativity and artistry to your development, I think is really helpful. And it gives you another, it's a sense of perspective. I think another area is audiences.
Hmm.
A lot of developers don't always think about their audience, who the customer is, right? And being able to identify that you have a lot of different customers, right? I've done a lot of the work that I've done has been database and server backend and whatever. And I've done some front end and some UI stuff, but my customers that I've had have been like, okay, if I'm dealing with data, I've got customers of the actual end user who wants the right data in the right time. But then I've got the business person who needs to know what this data means, other engineers that care about how that data moves around. And so like all of these audiences, and as a musician, when you're preparing a piece and you're getting ready to perform and you put together a program, who is your audience? Who's coming to see this? And oftentimes it too is varied, and kind of thinking about how do I put a concert together that everybody will enjoy at least part of it.
Yeah. One of the other parallels you mentioned to me before about being a member of a group performance or a team, whether it's an ensemble, orchestra, band, or software project, has a lot of parallels that when you described it to me, I was impressed at how similar teamwork in those two types of domains is similar.
Yeah, I think, right, that in the software team, sometimes you think, oh, it's not, you know, it's like, I have my world. I just have to do my thing. Or why can't so-and-so over there finish their work? I'm waiting on them to whatever. But when you have the experience of doing a live group performance, and it doesn't have to be just music, like theater, even film, any of those things, if so-and-so is not pulling their weight, right? If the actor with the next line doesn't say their thing, where are you going? How are you getting it, right? if the oboe soloist doesn't play the solo, you've got a problem, right? And so one of the things you kind of get into is okay, realizing that everybody is a contributor and that everybody kind of has to work together. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you get into with live performance, and like sketch comedy is probably a great example of this, is somebody does something and you got to go. You got to keep going, right? Yes, and, right, is your sketch comedy thing. But, you know, you're in the ensemble and the trombone player misses his entrance. That doesn't mean that the orchestra stops, right? Go down to your favorite city, you know, go to the orchestra, and the game I love to play in orchestra, and maybe it's because I'm a percussionist, but I like to sit up in the balcony and watch and look for the time when the percussionist in the back of the orchestra stands up and goes over to an instrument, pauses for a moment, and then sits back down.
They had
one note to play, and okay, for whatever reason, they missed that note. And it happens, and you can catch it once in a while. But the orchestra didn't stop. Everybody kept going, right? And I think that's part of, like, you know, how do we work together? How do we compensate for an issue, right? You know, soloist comes in, and they're 3 cents sharp. And there's 100 cents in a half step, for those of you who know anything about music, right? They're 3 cents sharp. That's enough that you can hear it, mm-hmm, right? The whole orchestra will come match it. They will match it so that it sounds good together. And, you know, yeah, were they right? Were they wrong? We can argue for days about what the right pitch center is for any given thing. So dealing with those ways of coming together and compensating. I think another area that I was reflecting on a little bit this week too is recovery, right? How long does it take the place where you work to make a decision?
A lot. A long time, rather.
Right? I was brought up in high school marching band, right? But in high school marching band, two counts to recover. That was the phrase. Two counts to recover. Okay. For all of you math nerds out there, a medium tempo is 120 beats per minute, right? A fast tempo is 180 beats per minute. Let's go on the fast tempo for a moment. 180 beats per minute. Two beats, two counts to recover when you've made a mistake is 666 milliseconds, two-thirds of a second, mm-hmm, right? Imagine if the people in your engineering organization could make a decision in two counts.
That'd be great.
Right? you're in the marching band and, you know, a player makes a wrong move and runs into you. Right? Your server just crashed. That marching band, that literally, they're going to try for two counts. It might take them 10, but they're going to be back on. Right? The server crashed, and you got a bunch of people sitting in the back going, well, I wonder what happened. Is it important? Do we need to fix this now? What's the right way to fix it? And like that experience in the music world, the theater world, the, you know, the show must go on, I think sort of helps us weed out alternatives very quickly, make a decision, make the wrong decision, who cares? Because the rest of the group is also anticipating and working with you, and you're going to get there. And so, like, yeah, that decision paralysis is a problem that entire organizations have. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, an engineer is like, should I do A or B? I'm like, I don't care.
Yeah, this is another laughably simple example I can think of is redundancy. In an orchestra, you have, I don't know, 10 plus violinists.
The violin's redundant.
Exactly, there's redundancy, but if a cymbal breaks or what right. have you.
Yes, the when you're looking at an orchestra, the front half of the stage, mm-hmm. there are multiple players in order to get volume.
Yeah.
Right? A single violin isn't really that loud. But there's one of every wind instrument, or yeah. one on a part.
Yeah.
Right? Like, even if you see two oboes back there, they're each playing two different parts. Right? And right, so everything back here is a solo part.
But even if you don't have person redundancy with, I don't know, two cymbalists, you do, as you go through a performance career in music, learn painfully the realities of needing redundancy and being self-reliant with redundancy, like playing a wind instrument. If a reed breaks, you better have redundancy of reeds, or else you're out for out of commission for the performance.
Right.
So parallels in team size, when you get into a tech career or an engineering team career, you need redundancy of people. If you have only one person with security credentials to access that server that's down, got a plan for redundancy of that kind. Same thing when you have a music gig and that reliable or unreliable trumpetist doesn't show up to your gig, you got to be able to call Joey.
Yeah.
Or what have you.
A guy I used to work with, Larry, he called it, we need to protect against bus error. Yeah. I'm like, bus error? What do you mean? Like, that's like from like the 80s, my computer would get the blue screen and it would say bus error and it would like shut off. Like, we're not doing anything like that. And he said, no, modern bus error is Muni hits you while you're biking to work. You get run over by a bus. How are we protecting against that? How are we communicating and sharing our information, our designs, our thought process, our work in progress, so that when an unfortunate thing happens or a fortunate thing happens, you get to go on vacation because somebody else can pick it up.
In music composition, there's a parallel that I can draw to programming. Feel free to disagree with annotating sheet music. So sheet music, a lot like code, is what's to be performed. There's obviously deviations from that, as we're all human performers. But one of the parallels I can think of with music and software engineering is commenting or annotating your sheet music or your code. Although there's less sharing of sheet music between people, so people can see each other's comments, I guess. But there's a parallel there, I suppose.
It's instructions. It's a layout of. I would think of the sheet music more of like sort of an architecture diagram, mm-hmm. right? Maybe yes, my notes in there end up being are commenting on how I want to see this architecture through. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you do actually. You want. I've gone through and been like, oh, wait, this is Alan Abel's marked up part for whatever. And like, he's a famous percussionist who, like, yeah, I trust what he did. Interestingly, recently I stumbled across the New York Phil has this online archive of marked conductor scores. Mm-hmm. So you can see that, like, oh, one of the conductors of the New York Phil marked this score this way. Mm-hmm. It helped give that conductor what they needed to lead the orchestra. Maybe another conductor can learn something from that. But yeah, if you don't put that out there and you don't share it, we give information silos, right? That's what we call them in the tech world.
So is there anything analogous to GitHub in the music world? Like, how do you get a hold of an annotated copy of a score by Michael Tilson Thomas or XYZ famous composer, you know? The library? Or?
The library usually doesn't have the extra annotated, right? The library usually has clean copies.
Yeah.
And so that becomes more of a cult following. Like, how do you track these people down? How do you get a hold of that? Whereas we have the ability and the responsibility as developers to make that information available, right? Mm-hmm. I have always approached the world with the idea of I can go and make a change in my life when I want to. But we need to set up the place that I'm working for that they're okay with that, that they won't fail because I've decided that I'm ready to make a change. I'm going to move across the country. I'm going to work for a different company. It's not about building it. We're not building job security by not commenting and not annotating and what have you. I think actually one of the things, and I think it was David Kieras when I was in college, one of my C professors said, each line of code that you write will have to be read and understood at least 7 times in its lifetime to fix bugs, to make enhancements about it, just maintenance. And interestingly, in my career, I've probably been the one who had to read it 4 of those 7 times, right? And so if I can do something today that makes me a year from now save 30 minutes, right? And it saved 30 minutes 4 different times, right? There's 2 developer hours coming from taking a moment now when I'm thinking through the problem and writing it down, right? When I'm learning a piece of music, I take notes so that the next time I come back to it, whether it's tomorrow or a month from now or whatever, I mean, like, oh, right.
So there's
how I approached it.
There's a parallel of sorts of technical debt where there's compounding costs from making mistakes early on in music composition or seeing music for the first time.
Wouldn't say so much seeing it for the first time, but like, I have done times where, as a percussionist, we play lots of things, right? And sometimes a composer writes and says, okay, you need these 10 instruments. Mm-hmm. And just says, you need these 10 instruments. And so I think, okay, I'm going to arrange these instruments this way, and I learn the piece. And then I put the piece on the shelf, and a year later I come back and go, how did I have those drums arranged? How did I have this arranged? Because now I'm resolving that problem to go back. And so it's taken me some time to learn, oh, wait, when I'm doing a piece like this, draw a diagram. Actually, nowadays, take a picture and then figure out how to get that with the score. But, come up with a way to keep track of that so that when you come back to it. That to me, like, if I'm learning something and don't take good notes while I'm learning a piece of music, that's my technical debt.
Got it. Dialing back time-wise or timeline-wise, do you mind telling our audience a little bit about how, obviously, you got your undergraduate degree in computer engineering and musical performance, but how you got your first software engineering job? And
I did one of the classic, like, I got an internship and then event, and they let me come back for a second summer, and then they hired me in. But what was interesting here was I had sent my resume off to a handful of companies. I grew up in the Pittsburgh region. I was at the University of Michigan for college, and I was planning to go back for the summer. The dorms closed, go sleep at my parents' house. It's free.
Yeah.
And so I had sent my resume to a handful of places that a mentor friend of mine suggested, and I think 2 of them ultimately responded, and only 1 of them bothered to even do a phone screen. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting here that I learned much, much later, I think it was after I was a full-time employee, when my resume came through, the on-site recruiter passed it to the engineering team, and the engineering team's like, intern. But the QA team was like, yes, please, yes. And I got an internship on the QA tools team, mm-hmm. right? And so, and...
Who is this employer?
This was Co-Manage Corporation. They don't exist anymore. They were bought out many years ago. But they were in the telecom industry. And they had some products that were helping telecoms understand what hardware they had that wasn't fully utilized. And actually, it was kind of cool that they helped Sprint. Sprint installed the software in one of their locations and found 10 times the cost of the software in unutilized equipment in the first day.
Wow.
Because, like, telcos are notoriously bad at keeping records. And phone services are constantly being changed and upgraded and moved, and the technician goes in and finds an open port and plugs something in, but doesn't write it down.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they were in that industry.
This is a common pattern we've seen actually with guests of ours, that first job isn't necessarily as a software engineer, but it might be on the QA team at a company that heavily depends on software or a software product.
And yes, and interestingly, I was actually brought into the QA tools team.
Yeah.
As opposed to like just the QA team, and that's a really great, and I've had the opportunity, like there are some people who poo-poo the QA team.
Yeah.
And they're like, ah, oh, they're just the QA team. And there's nothing, I mean, they are more important to me than the development team sometimes, right? They protect me as a developer, right? They make me look good by finding the crap that I wrote before it gets out in the world.
And for our audience that doesn't know QA, QA is quality assurance. So that gives a lot more context to what Christian's
right.
saying.
Yes, they're helping me as a developer make sure that my code is great.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that I think working on in a QA department, working with the QA tools team, is it further gives that, and it probably goes back to my performance OCD, but gives me that perspective of, I take great pride in not handing off code that I haven't validated. And my least fun late nights almost always involved cursing out another coworker who committed code that they clearly didn't run because it either doesn't compile or it crashes on lunch.
Yeah.
And having dealt with failed performances, having worked in a QA department, and really understanding that it is my responsibility to make my code solid. And solid is always a trade-off.
Starting your career in QA or on the QA tools team, did you find that as you moved on in your career and encountered more teams that you worked with or were a member of, that you had a advantaged perspective in knowing all of the various tricks of the trade for QA and being able to deliver, relative to your peers, a more reliable output as a software engineer?
I guess the question in my mind that I'm thinking is, how much of the testing and verification mindset comes out of having experience there,
mm-hmm.
Having experience with auto-graded coding assignments in college, or having experience with failing at performing.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere between those three things, right? I think in being involved in QA and understanding some of the hows probably was helpful in putting those to practice. My level of OCD, I'll call it, probably started a long time before then.
Mm-hmm.
My parents tell me all the time, I would take everything apart and then try to put it back together. And I think that mindset from like being a 6-year-old still exists. That I take my code apart and put it back together. But at the same time, I feel like I have learned how to take it apart and put it back together pretty quickly. And that's one thing too, is I don't get lost in it. And that's, I think, another area that some engineers have a challenge with of, well, of course I could write better code, but you didn't give me enough time. I don't have enough time for that. No, I can't write it that fast. And almost never is that true. And that is a skill, and it takes practice. But high school English teacher, and I'm old. Dot matrix printer, you know, dot matrix printers, right? Fanfold paper. Okay, there are probably people that are like, what are you talking about? But right, the paper used to all be like, it was all attached, and you had to like rip it apart at each sheet so you could make these banners. So dot matrix printer banner with the letters as tall as an 8.5, right, sheet of paper. It's never done. It's only due. And she had it up there in terms of our writing, right? We'd write an essay, and her point is you could always improve it. As a musician, that performance date is set. I performed a piece 2 weeks ago. I'm still practicing it because I'm not done with it. Mm-hmm. I can perform it better perhaps the next time. So it, my piece of software, it has a due date. How good can I make it for that due date? Mm-hmm. Right? And what is it that I did in the past that I can leverage to write better tests, to just get it out on the paper quicker? Well, I guess we're not getting out on the paper, but get it into the computer quicker. Like, how can I approach this problem so that I can become efficient with my use of time? Mm-hmm. So that, yes, the due date is there. Yes, every once in a while I have yelled at people and told them that they are full of crap. No, I cannot meet that due date. And I have been on the other side where I've looked at engineers and said, you're full of crap. You can absolutely meet that due date. You need to make some decisions quickly and go for it. And if you're horribly wrong, I'll catch you. Right? Like, if I'm your manager, that's my job, is to catch you if you make a mistake in that process. But 9 times out of 10, you just need to focus, make the decisions, and go.
So as having been a hiring manager, Is being a musician an actual criteria that you pay attention to with job applicants? Or
I read, there's a blog post, Rans on Software. He has a blog post, like, I think it's called A Hook and a Glimpse, or A Glimpse and a Hook. And a friend of mine pointed me to this blog post that he wrote about how he reads a resume. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, is he sitting behind me right now and just writing down what I do? Like, it's interesting. Like, he's like, I'll read the first line and then I go to the bottom and then I come back to the top. And I do. I don't necessarily look for, are they a musician? Like, give me 3 resumes that are identical except for the bottom, and that's going to make a difference. Mm-hmm. Right? What do you do outside of engineering? What do you do that makes you a whole person? Mm-hmm. Because as we said at the beginning, there's the artistry of engineering, and that artistry is important to me. And whether you get your artistry because you are involved in something that's literally the arts, or maybe you're really into some sort of a sport, or something outside of engineering, really just that is there.
So that's an important part to people's resumes, is that last few lines of a resume hinting at people's extracurricular interests?
It is to me.
Okay.
Now, I'm also not your, like, I don't know that that's advice that carries to other,
certainly.
Other people. I mean, there are my idea about interviewing. I do not anymore do live coding interviews. I don't do it. Mm. It's not real. It's not real.
Okay.
Right? What I want to know is, can you solve a problem?
Sure.
Right? And I have done take home, like, cause nobody does well when, can you do that? How do you do that?
Certainly.
What are you doing? Nope. That's wrong. No.
Proctoring is really rough on the process.
Yeah. I also don't believe in an 8-hour interview.
For sure.
So like, I'm in this weird world where like, no, I'd rather have you, I would rather have you meet multiple people in a group setting. Which some candidates probably found intimidating, but I tried to warn them. But I'm like, we're going to only have you in the office for 2 hours, but you're going to meet 8 people, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to meet 4 people and then 4 people and a couple of other, maybe you'll have a couple of one-on-one moments in there, but meet a bunch of the team. And then instead of sitting here for another 6 hours talking about things, I'm going to send you home and say, don't spend more than 2 hours on this. I do not expect a complete solution.
Yeah.
But take a look at this problem. And yeah, because that's, no, it's not.
Certainly. So outside of recommendations we can give our audience about how to approach their career and that sort of thing, we should definitely have an opportunity to give you a chance to plug what you're doing at Little Mission Studio and your personal practice as a consultant of software engineering.
Yeah, right. And I guess, so as a musician world, right, Little Mission Studio, we're here in San Francisco, and we hope that we're bringing really high quality lessons, group lessons and private lessons, to people of all ages. And what we have found that's really interesting in our student base, we've been in business for 3 years so far, and nearly 50% of our student base is adults. And so, like, I'm here sort of saying, hey, the creativity and the artistry and these experiences and recovery and being able to put a performance on, and they all relate. And I think they relate to more than just engineering. Mm-hmm. Right, I think they relate to many aspects of life, and what has really been encouraging is that there is a population, at least in San Francisco, who sees this and says, as an adult, it is important for me to pursue creative things, to pursue things that make me think in a different way than maybe my day job does, and so whether you come, you're in San Francisco and you come to us, or even any of the other, there are plenty of other music places in San Francisco and elsewhere, online lessons, all sorts of things. But and theater, like, I'm good friends with the guys that own Piano Fight, which is a sketch comedy. They do a lot of sketch comedy, but they own the venue in San Francisco, and so they are bringing adults together to do this theater stuff. And it's those creative things that I think really help build out engineering.
Okay.
Yeah, and then in my engineering world, I'm working some with a friend who, he's based out of Chicago right now. I've done some work with him in the past, and he's doing a sort of restaurant management software.
But by and large, people can get a hold of you via the internet.
Yeah.
We have a comments section, which I'll forward any comments you guys have for Christian or questions.
Yeah. And you can, I'll let you post my email in the comments section.
Absolutely. Check out the show notes on the site. Two things I want to plug real quick myself are, one, sign up for our mailing list, which you can do on our website. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, and by all means, comment on our interviews. All of our guests that we have are happy to answer your guys' questions and whatnot. So,
yeah.
Dude, thank you for joining us, Christian.
Absolutely.
It's been freaking awesome.